die Presse.
Dieser Podcast wird unterstützt von Erste Group und Vienna Insurance Group.
Hallo und herzlich willkommen zu einem neuen Kapitel der East Side Stories. Wir sind Martina Czarnowska
und Thomas Seifert.
Schön, dass Sie dabei sind bei unserer letzten Folge vor der Sommerpause. Die East Side Stories machen nämlich Urlaub, während wir zwei schon an der nächsten Ausgabe von European Voices arbeiten.
Ja, aber immerhin hast du dir jetzt gerade eine Auszeit genommen, ne?
Ja, ich war in Polen auf den Masuren, besser gesagt in der Region Ermland-Masuren. Eine wunderschöne Gegend, voller Störche im Moment übrigens.
Störche, die gibt es im Burgenland auch, ja?
Ja, aber dort gibt es sicher viel mehr Störche auf den Masuren.
Sehr gut.
Auf jeden Fall. Diese Region ist nicht nur sehr lieblich, sondern auch interessant. Sie liegt nicht weit weg von Kaliningrad und Weißrussland. Und es ist eine Region, in der die deutschen Spuren des ehemaligen Ostpreußen noch nicht völlig verwischt sind. Wie etwa in einem Dorfwirtshaus, über dessen Eingangstür das Schild des früheren Kolonialwaren- und Flaschenbierverkaufs prangt. Aber weit öfter sind andere Schilder zu sehen.
Ja, und welche?
Informationsschilder, dass die EU etwas mitfinanziert hat. Eine Schnellstraße, einen Radweg, die Renovierung einer Kirche. Polen hat die EU-Förderungen ausgesprochen gut genützt.
Wie das Burgenland.
Da haben wir wieder eine Parallele.
Genau.
Also auch so wie im Burgenland hat sich das Bild der Städte und der Dörfer in den vergangenen 20 Jahren sehr verändert.
Aber du wirbst gerade für einen Urlaub in Polen und ich für einen im Burgenland, oder wie?
Ja, warum nicht? Allerdings würde ich auf die Masuren nicht im Juli oder im August fahren. Die Gegend ist da sehr überlaufen.
Aber kühl?
Ja, ein bisschen kühler, obwohl es jetzt auch schon wieder heiß wird dort. Aber immerhin gibt es Abkühlung bei den vielen, vielen Seen, die es dort gibt.
Klingt toll.
Ja, aber unsere heutige Sprachnachricht enthält einen völlig anderen Tipp, einen sehr außergewöhnlichen.
Genau, und das ist eine Einladung nach Kiew.
Das mag jetzt seltsam klingen, soll aber keineswegs zynisch sein. Dennoch, was du vor kurzem selber dort, Thomas, und von der trotzigen Lebenslust in der Stadt begeistert. Galerien, Konzerte, volle Lokale, eine Kunst- und Clubszene, die sich trotz Luftalarm, trotz Ausgangssperre, trotz Krieg ein Stück Normalität und Freiheit verteidigt hat.
Ja, also ich habe das auch als sehr, sehr außergewöhnlich und sehr inspirierend empfunden, dieser Widerstandswille und auch diese Lebenslust. Aber gut, danach war ich auch noch in Prag und am Rand der Sicherheitskonferenz GLOBSEC habe ich dort mit Alexandra Matwitschuk gesprochen, die Leiterin des Center for Civil Liberties. Und dieses Center hat 2022 den Friedensnobelpreis erhalten. Und Alexandra Matwitschuk dokumentiert seit 12 Jahren die russischen Kriegsverbrechen.
Und genau das ist der Bogen unserer heutigen Folge. Dieselbe Ukraine, zwei Gesichter. Die Lebensfreude in Kiew und die Dokumentation des Grauens, das diese Lebensfreude jeden Tag bedroht.
Ja, aber beginnen wir mal mit der hellen Seite dieser Geschichte. Und unsere heutige Sprachnachricht kommt von der Künstlerin Annette Sagal.
Voice Message. What's up, Kiew? Привіт, добрий день. Мене звати Анет Сагаль. My name is Annette Sagal. I'm from Kiev, Ukraine. I'm an artist. Kiev is blossoming. Events are happening. We are fundraising for our army, for our charities, and of course struggling with air raid sirens, but life still goes on. We have shelters to hide in. Yeah. We invite you to come here. It's relatively safe. It's at your own risk, but still there's a lot of things to do. It's kind of safe. People are here very welcome. The food is amazing. The arts are beautiful. So if you ever wished to visit Ukraine or Kiev, now is the time to do it. I think that Хвильовий bar is in Поділ. It's a very great place to have a drink, to dance. They always have some events, some parties, music, good DJs, live music. Also Squad 17B. They are kind of arts, music, theater, food spot. There's a mix of everything. And they are always also fundraising for good causes. And there's a lot of great artists coming, DJs, live music, everything, poetry readings. It's there. So I'd highly recommend to visit.
Das war Annette Sagal aus Kiew, einem Ort, an dem die Menschen auch nach Jahren des Krieges ihre Lebensfreude sich nicht nehmen lassen. Und doch, immer mitgedacht, die Luftalarme, die Schutzräume. Es ist relativ sicher, sagt sie. Auf eigene Gefahr, fügt sie auch hinzu. Diese Lebenslust ist die eine Seite. Die andere, Thomas, hast du in Prag aufgenommen und sie ist sehr viel dunkler.
Ja, leider sehr, sehr viel dunkler. Alexander Matwitschuk kämpft seit Jahren um einen Sondergerichtshof für das Verbrechen der Aggression gegen die Ukraine. Kurz zur Einordnung. Der Internationale Strafgerichtshof in Den Haag kann zwar Kriegsverbrechen und Verbrechen gegen die Menschlichkeit und Völkermord verfolgen, aber ausgerechnet das Verbrechen der Aggression, also die Entscheidung an der Spitze eines Staates, überhaupt einen Angriffskrieg zu beginnen, das kann er im Fall von Russland nicht ahnden, weil Russland ein entsprechendes Statut nie unterzeichnet hat. Und genau diese Lücke soll der neue Sondergerichtshof schließen. Und das wäre der erste übrigens seiner Art seit den Tribunalen von Nürnberg und Tokio.
Vielleicht noch ein paar Fakten. Die Ukraine und der Europarat haben das Gründungsabkommen im Juni 2025 in Straßburg unterzeichnet. Und im Mai diesen Jahres haben dann in Chisinau 36 Staaten und die Europäische Union das erweiterte Teilabkommen angenommen. Der ukrainische Außenminister sprach damals vom Point of No Return. Sitz des Tribunals wird Den Haag. Ein Vorbereitungsteam arbeitet bereits seit dem Frühjahr. Und ab dem Sommer sollen Richter, Richterinnen und ein Anklageteam bestellt werden. Mit der eigentlichen Arbeit wird erst 2027 gerechnet.
Ja, genau. Und damit kommen wir auch gleich noch zum allerheikelsten Punkt, nämlich den, mit dem Matwitschuk gleich beginnt. Aggression ist eben ein sogenanntes Führungsverbrechen. Es trifft nicht den einzelnen Soldaten, der an diesem Angriffskrieg teilnimmt, sondern die, die den Krieg angeordnet haben. Und Matwitschuk spricht eben davon der sogenannten Troika, meint damit eben den Präsidenten, Premierminister, Außenminister. Und das Problem ist, solange die im Amt sind, genießen sie persönliche Immunität. Das trifft ja auch auf sehr viele Staatsoberhäupter und Regierungschefs auch in westlichen Ländern zu. Und die zentrale Frage ist, die ich gestellt habe, kann ein solches Tribunal einen amtierenden Präsidenten wie zum Beispiel Wladimir Putin überhaupt anklagen?
Unfortunately, this decision was made because of pressure of several countries of the core group, which I think was a wrong decision because it's international court and it can express international interest. And according to the UN Court of Justice, international court can overcome the immunity of Troika. But here we are with such circumstances. So what we have current moment, at least Special Tribunal on Aggression will conduct investigation of the personal involvement of President Trump, President Putin and other two members of Troika. And legally, it means that when he will lost his position, he will find himself under the trial. But it's also possible some changes can be done by the judges of Special Tribunal, because they can insist potentially that they literally express international interest and have a power.
But of course, that also means that you have to get custody of him. You have to have.
No, it doesn't mean so, because the statute of special tribunal provides opportunity to conduct a trial in absentia.
But still, of course, it's different issue if somebody have standing trial before a court.
It's completely different issue, but it's another court that Nuremberg. Nuremberg was victorious trial.
Yes.
It was a trial where Nazi war criminals were tried when Nazi regime had collapsed. But we are not waiting to the end of this war. And this is another way of thinking, which is I want to emphasize revolutionary. Because while Nazi war tribunal trial was essential step to establish law and justice past century, it also established like a norm that justice is privileged to winners. But justice is not privileged to winners. And that is why we have to create the special tribunal now. We have our own historical task to make the justice independent on the fact when and how the war will end.
Yes, maybe let's move from this arena to another one and let's go to a space where basically war is very personal. And let's start with Bucha, because it's such a topic. And basically, as far as I understand, it's now pretty clear that even in the perpetrators, we have a clear picture of who they were, even lower ranks. So we know a lot about war criminals that did these crimes there. And of course, Bucha is not the worst. It's one of many, but let's use it as an example because it was the first one that the, at least the world was got aware of right after full-scale invasion. So how do you think, at the end of the day, how can justice be brought?
I work with people affected by this war directly, and I know that they see justice very differently. For some people, justice means to see the perpetrators behind the bars. But for another people, justice means to get compensations because they lost everything. For some people, justice means the possibility to know truth, what happened with their loved ones. But for another people, justice means possibility to be publicly heard, to get this public recognition that something that happened with them and their families is not just immoral, but also illegal. And we have to develop a comprehensive justice strategy to reach all these needs with different elements and institutions. And one recent story, a month ago, approximately, my colleague organized a huge gathering of victims of Russian war crimes from Kherson with representatives of national legal enforcement bodies. Probably you know that Russia do human safari in Kherson. It's horrible practice when drone literally hunting civilians and killed people on bicycles, the whole families in civilian cars, a two-year-old baby who was just playing in his garden. It was brilliantly described in a report of International Commission Inquiry of UN's Human Rights Council. And at the end of this meeting, she asked people, what justice means for you? And people told something very, very central. They told, justice means for us, we want the world to know. We want the world to know what Russia have done to us. And this is a very Bible terms, intent to ensure truth about this war. And I think in this regard, the Special Tribunal of Russia will fulfill this function.
But of course, as we speak, you spoke about Kherson. Similar things happened in Nikopol. Even I heard from a friend, she's living outside Kharkiv, even in Serkuni, you have now
in Sumy,
all these regions, you have these drones. And basically, probably as we speak here in Prague, maybe war crimes are happening. So
yes, and it's a legitimate result of the wrong policy. I will try to find numbers, but what I want to say, ironically, the Trump's year of negotiation became the deadliest year for Ukrainian civilians. The number of deaths and injuries among Ukrainian civilians increased in 31% in comparison with the previous year, according to UN. And this is not something that you expect from peace negotiation,
yes,
right?
Absolutely.
It showed that something is going wrong. And I will tell you what is going wrong. We lost human dimension. Because Americans' negotiators, they interested mostly in natural minerals, geopolitical interests. When they speak about occupied territories, they speak like about empty spaces. But I'm sorry, the spaces are not empty. Millions of people live there. So the question is, what will be with them? And when it became visible for Russians that people doesn't matter in this peace negotiation, that human dimension vanished, they understood that there is no red lines, they can do whatever they want. And the figures which I tried to find, in the first 4 months of this year, according to UN, civilian casualties were 21% higher than in the same period of the last year. So we see that the trend is going up very dangerously.
Well, and I think that brings up the question is one thing if I'm, let's say, a Russian artillery soldier and I fire some, whatever, shell to some city, right? But it's a different story if I'm a drone pilot. I mean, I see this more or less in high resolution that I'm going to kill.
It's example of the bright example of dehumanization. Let me tell you the case in which my colleagues were working on. It was a case from Sumy region this winter. The elder couple tried to evacuate by themselves from occupied village. And husband pulled his wife on winter sled. to the place where Ukrainian rescuers were waiting for them because they can't move to occupied village and to the close distance. And one FPV drones throw explosion directly to women, and an hour the man her husband haven't left the body, he crying, and then the next FPV drone killed him precisely. And yes, the person who were behind this drone, this person saw that it's just elder couple who tried to evacuate from the village. I can't also understand what in the hearts and minds. I just know from the history, general history, and from the experience too with dealing with an enormous amount of crimes in this war, that this is how dehumanization is look like. Mm.
And also, I think at one point you said what we're seeing is also a collapse of international rule of law, international law, the Geneva Convention. I mean, we have a lot of laws that basically should govern how wars are conducted. Even in war, we have rules. And what happened to these rules?
There is law and there is architecture. In architecture, gone. The world order that based on UN Charter and international law has collapsed. This system was created after the Second World War to prevent wars and mass violence, but now it's just stolen. It's reproducing realistic movement. For obvious reason, even my smartphone has an expiration date. The system has never been reformed. Hmm. So, unfortunately, it's easy to predict that such fires, like wars, will emerge more and more often in different parts of the globe because this international environment is faulty and sparkling everywhere, and because there are aggressive states who try to be beneficiary of these turbulent times. I'm doubt how historians in the future will call this period.
But do you think that this is like a larger problem that basically, let's say, some powerful forces, and you see that, you know, there's Donald Trump, Xi Jinping, Putin, they are in one camp, and then there is the mere mortals like you and me and maybe others, and even...
It's not chaos. It's a battle how the new world order will look like. And the people, politicians who you mentioned, have their clear vision. They want the world of strongest. And last year, we made a significant step back into past to the world of strongest. But let's be honest, this world wasn't great because the world of strongest is very fragile. The world where you can't rely on rule of law, but only will of strongest, it's dangerous for everyone without any exception, even for those who think that they will be beneficiary, because to be a strongest, it's also a process. You have to prove every time that you are on the top of this hierarchy of violence. It means that you have to send your citizens to different parts of the globe to demonstrate strength. So, no doubt, we know from the history of humankind that the world where you can't rely on rule of law, but it's governed by will of strongest, it's always a world of wars and mass violence. And while this decision was made last year by several politicians, I still hope that it's temporary and we as a humankind will manage to return to the right course of history. Hmm.
And I mean, also, do you think that if there is no accountability, imagine, let's say, in Ukraine or in Austria or here in Czechia, we would just send the police home and close with no more jails, right? And of course, most people, I think, will still behave normally. I don't think that people would be criminals just because they can. But of course, there would be some people when they see that there are no consequences to that they have to fear, that very bad things can happen and will happen maybe. And this is, a fear that many people have, that if we don't have accountability, like we had after, you know, the wars in ex-Yugoslavia, Kosovo, Milosevic, eventually he was in jail, right? So this was a clear signal, okay, there is certain lines. If you cross them, you end in jail.
All this hell which we face in Ukraine, it's a result of total impunity that Russia enjoyed for decades. Russian troops committed horrible crimes in Chechnya, in Moldova, in Georgia, in Mali, in Libya, in Syria, in other countries of the world. have never been punished. They believe they can do whatever they want. So while we are trying to break the circle of impunity, we are doing this not just for people in Ukraine, not just for people from other countries who have already suffered from Russian war crimes, but also in order to prevent next Russian attack to the next nation. My Russian human rights colleagues made a report. They analyzed Russian tactics in Chechnya, in Syria, in Ukraine, and they told this is the same war crime playbook. Like war crime playbook. And they titled this report, The Chain of Wars, Chain of Crimes, Chain of Impunity. Everything, like one example, Russians destroyed to the scratch a 500,000 city, Grozny. Then Russian did the same with Aleppo. So no doubt that they repeated in Mariupol.
And as a Ukrainian, there's the fifth year of war will be next year in February. We will look at the full-scale invasion, of course. And actually, it's one of the longest wars in Europe. If we look back to 2014, when it actually started with the annexation of Crimea and parts of the Donbas. I mean, how can you also continue your work? And how do you find the strength to, of course, you deal with the darkest of the dark sides of this war? And where can you still find hope that this war will end, that there will be accountability, that there will not be impunity? Where do you get that energy from, so to speak?
People in Ukraine dream about peace. Because war is horrible. It's probably the most horrible thing that just can happen in human life. But we want peace, not occupation. Because occupation also horrible. Occupation is the same war, just in another form. Occupation doesn't decrease human suffering. Occupation just makes human suffering invisible. And working with the war crimes for 12 years, I know that Russian occupation is not just changing one state flag to another. Russian occupation means enforced disappearances, torture, rape, denial of your identity, forcible adoption of your own children, filtration camps and mass graves. This is Russian occupation. So no doubt that people in Ukraine dream about peace, but simply don't want to be occupied. And that is why we are still resisting. We have no other choice. Tiredness is luxury for us because we will be killed. Putin openly said there is no Ukrainian nation, there is no Ukrainian language, there is no Ukrainian culture. For 12 years, we are documenting in occupied territories how this war is converted in horrible practice. Because Russian there physically exterminate active local people in communities, mayors, journalists, children writers, teachers, environmentalists, priests. They ban Ukrainian language and culture. They destroyed and robbed Ukrainian cultural heritage. And they take Ukrainian children, separated them with their families, and illegally deported them to Russia, put them in Russian re-education camps, told them, you're not Ukrainian, you're Russian children, your parents, your families refused from you, and you will be adopted by Russian families who will bring you up as Russian. So we have no other choice. If we stop resisting and Russia will occupy the whole Ukraine, we will cease to exist. It's obvious. So you ask me about hope. I think that we have to define the word hope properly. And while we're in Czech Republic, I want to quote the Václav Havel. He told, hope is not a confidence that everything will be fine. Hope, it's a deep understanding that all our efforts have a huge meaning.
Maybe you want to just talk a little about the work that you do, because we're talking about not hundreds of cases, we're talking about thousands of cases, we're talking about a huge archive, basically.
Only in our database we have more than 100,000 episodes of war crimes. It's a huge amount, but still just the tip of iceberg, because Russia uses war crimes as the methods of warfare. Russia deliberately inflicts enormous pain to civilians in order to break people's resistance and occupy the country. So we document something more than just violations of Geneva and Hague conventions. We are documenting human pain. And while this war turns people into the numbers, what we are literally doing, we are returning people their names, because people are not numbers, and life of each person matters. Let me illustrate it with a story from our database. This is a story of 10-year-old boy Andriy from city Brovary near Kyiv. When large-scale war started, his parents did something that every parent will do in such situation. They took their son, some hastily gathering belongings, some documents, to drive away from this dangerous region. But on the road, they faced with a line of Russian tanks. And one armored personal carrier hit civilian car and deliberately ran over civilian car. And Andrei told that it seems that his father has already dead. But his mother, she was alive because they sit together on the back seat and his mother spoke to him. But next second, someone pulled out the boy through the window and thrown him to the road. And next moment, Russians hit gas tank of civilian car. And what happened? This 10-year-old boy told to my colleague how his mother burned alive on his own eyes in this civilian car. There is no legitimate reason in doing such things. There is also no monitoring necessity, no excuse. Russians have done this and enormous amount of others horrible things only because they could. We must stop them.
Das war unser Gespräch mit Alexandra Matwiczuk. Zwei Gedanken bleiben besonders hängen. Zum einen, Gerechtigkeit ist kein Privileg der Sieger. Nürnberg etwa war ein Tribunal nach dem Zusammenbruch Nazi-Deutschlands. Matwiczuk und ihre Mitstreiterinnen wollen jedoch nicht warten, bis der Krieg vorbei ist. Sie möchten Rechenschaft, jetzt, mitten im Krieg. Das nennen sie selbst revolutionär. Und zweitens, die menschliche Dimension. Mehr als 100.000 dokumentierte Kriegsverbrechen allein in ihrer Datenbank. Und trotzdem, sagt Matwiczuk, ist es nur die Spitze des Eisbergs. Ihre Arbeit bestehe darin, den Menschen ihren Namen zurückzugeben, weil Menschen keine Zahlen sind.
Ja, und genau hier schließt sich der Bogen zu Annette in Kiew. Das Tanzen und das Dokumentieren, das sind nicht Gegensätze, sondern zwei Formen derselben Widerstandskraft. Oder mit dem Satz, den Matwiczuk in Prag von Václav Havel geborgt hat, Hoffnung ist nicht die Gewissheit, dass alles gut ausgeht. Hoffnung ist die tiefe Überzeugung, dass das, was wir tun, einen Sinn hat.
Den Link zum vollständigen Gespräch mit Alexandra Matwiczuk finden Sie in den Shownotes.
Ebenso Informationen zur aktuellen Ausgabe der European Voices.
Das war Kapitel 16 der East Side Stories. Das nächste folgt im September.
Schön, dass Sie dabei waren und einen schönen Sommer.
Hören Sie uns wieder.
Servus.
Da aus Virginia.